to begin this evening's talk with a special prayer that was translated from the Persian. It's the recorded prayers that Abdu'l-Bahá made in New York for the old Columbia Gramophone Company. It is the only recording of his voice ever made. And this is one of the prayers on the recording.
Linnea.
Praise be to God that we are present in this radiant meeting and turn toward the kingdom of Abha. That which we behold is due to the grace and bounty of the Blessed Perfection. We are atoms, and He is the Sun of Reality. We are drops, and He is the greatest ocean. Though we are poor, yet the treasury of the kingdom is full of overflowings. Though we are weak, yet the confirmation of the Supreme Concourse is abundant. Though we are helpless, yet our refuge and shelter is His Holiness, Baha'u'llah.
Abdu'l-Bahá was liberated from a life spent almost totally in prison or exile. And in 1908, it was with the Young Turks Rebellion that all political prisoners were freed, among them Abdu'l-Bahá. One of his first thoughts was to visit and spend some time with the friends and his disciples in the Western world. He was in poor health at the time, but nonetheless, in 1910, without telling a soul, he set sail, or made ready to set sail, for the Western world. However, he got only as far as Egypt. His health was, as I said, was in very poor condition, so he stopped. Oh, the PA system is on. I'm sorry. So he, in Egypt, he had to remain. And the following year, this was in 1911, in August, at the age of 67, he embarked once more from Cairo and arrived in London on September the 4th, 1911. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
All right?
Also, we have some seats over in front. If the back would come in front, that'll make it a lot easier on the speaker.
And so on this date begins the most remarkable mission ever documented by a man of God. He undertook a three-year mission of the Western world, which Shoghi Effendi termed the culmination of Abdu'l-Bahá's ministry, in particular his eight-month tour of the United States and Canada. This is in God Passes By, where he states this. This holy exemplar, our ideal, our perfect man, had never in his life faced a public audience, had never attended a school, he had never moved in Western circles, and was unfamiliar, totally unfamiliar with Western customs and the language. He spoke to members of all the world's religions, to representatives of every high-ranking government, to delegates at a peace conference, to Esperantists, to theosophists, to liberals and humanitarians of all kinds, to ambassadors, and to newspaper reporters. More than this, even while such important topics were being discussed by members of these very elite gatherings, Abdu'l-Bahá would be found sometimes in a corner with a poor and ragged little boy on his lap who would be telling him that if his mother didn't have any money, she was in such poor health, his mother would die. Abdu'l-Bahá always found time for the children, and for the very poor, and for the very desperate. Accounts bordering on the miraculous are told and retold everywhere he went of how he healed a little girl who was crippled, of answering a question before it was asked, of answering a letter before it was mailed, of saving a would-be suicide who suddenly saw Abdu'l-Bahá's face in front of him. The list is endless. It was compiled by those who were there and witnessed these events. He spoke in Persian, with his interpreter translating into the language. Once, during his last day in London, a reporter asked of his future plans, and Abdu'l-Bahá replied in faultless English. When the reporter expressed surprise, Abdu'l-Bahá strode up and down and uttered a string of elaborate English words, and he ended with a laugh, saying, "Very difficult English words, I say." And when he spoke, he seldom remained in one place. He would stride up and down, gesturing at intervals, but never with a dogmatic downward stroke of his hands. And you have to sort of picture this. He would never point a finger at anyone or anything dogmatic like this. But he would always have this encouraging upward swing of his hands as he was speaking, as though he were taking you up with him, elevating you with him as he spoke. His voice was described as a resonant bell, very penetrating, yet a very soft voice. For those who saw him and observed him, he personified the sovereignty of God on earth, who, because of his great power, was also filled with a great humility. All instinctively felt the person who was Abdu'l-Bahá. A little girl in Paris, seeing his portrait in one of the shop windows, stopped her mother and exclaimed, "There is a picture of Jesus Christ when he was old." At a reception of high-ranking dignitaries, most of them would bow when they met him for the first time. Some would even kneel. And he refused payment or gifts for any of his public appearances. In fact, it would be he who would send gifts to his host or hostess. And his tips at hotels were so generous, they say, as to cause astonishment. Some of the money that he had given to one of the chambermaids, the girl remarked, she said, "This is sacred money." She said, "I will never spend it on myself." Now, some of these talks, I'm going to highlight, so some of these talks will be out of sequence of his actual trips. So just to get the record straight geographically, after he left Egypt, Cairo, Egypt, he set sail for London, where he remained about a month. And then he arrived in Paris, where he stayed not much more than that. And then, because of his health, he went back to Egypt and passed the winter in Ramla, Egypt. Then it was the following year, in 1912, that he set sail from Naples to the United States of America, where he remained for 8 months. Then from America, New York Harbor, he sailed to Liverpool, England, went back to Paris again for the second time. He visited London twice and Paris twice, and also some other cities in Germany, and then went back to the Holy Land. So that is his actual itinerary, although I will be having all of the talks from London highlights from that all at once. It's a little easier that way. The very first address that he gave to a Western audience was at the City Temple on September 10th, about a week after he arrived. And although his coming had not been advertised, the place was filled to its capacity. There were few who would ever forget the sight of this majestic figure in his creamy white robes, his turban to match, ascending the pulpit steps to address a public gathering for the first time in his life. And it was a Christian place of worship, which is perhaps significant. The talk was reprinted in its entirety in one of the newspapers in London. He stayed there, as I said, only 1 month for the first time. There he addressed St. John's Westminster Church, the Theosophical Headquarters, the Higher Thought Center, as well as addressing smaller gatherings for the Baha'is. Only occasionally would he ever allow himself to go outside and visit the streets or the countryside of England. Sometimes, much to the delight of the Baha'is there, he would speak to their groups at their centers, and he would usually deliver these discourses very brief and always to the point, which always bared upon his mission, the teachings of his father. Then from London, he went to Paris. He stayed there the first time for 9 weeks. In the book, Paris Talks, this book covers the addresses he gave there during this time, as well as those talks he gave on his second trip to Paris. Then from Paris he returned to Ramla, Egypt, where he passed that winter. And while in Egypt, he gave interviews to the Khedive, the Abbas Hilmi Pasha II. He was introduced to Lord Kitchener. He met with the highest-ranking Muslim leaders. He met the members of the Turkish Parliament and the editors of the leading newspapers of Cairo and Alexandria. Then he left again for his trip to the United States and back again to Europe. His second sojourn to Paris was almost exactly 1 year later, and he stayed approximately 2 months at that time. The book that is now out of print called Abdu'l-Bahá'í Divine Philosophy covers the talks that he gave in Paris the second time. Before the Paris Esperanto group, he spoke on the value of a universal language. And this is a quotation from Abdu'l-Bahá'í Divine Philosophy. There was a deep silence as Abdu'l-Bahá rose, but his remarks were punctuated by cheers as he walked up and down the banquet hall, stopping to emphasize with frequent gestures. He addressed the theological seminary to an audience which was comprised of clergymen, theology students, and professors. He addressed the Paris Theosophical Society, where he made no mention at all of theosophical points. He also addressed the Spiritual Alliance, which was a humanitarian society. And in the morning, large groups of Baha'is would gather at his apartments where he would give informal talks. Every Friday evening, he addressed an assemblage at the home of the Dreyfus Barneys. And every Monday afternoon, he visited a group at the studio of an American artist, a Mr. Scott, in the Latin Quarter. His time in Paris was completely filled. Sometimes he would go into the streets of Paris and simply wander. He was invited while in Paris to spend an hour or two with the Japanese ambassador in his hotel suite. Lady Blomfield, in The Chosen Highway, records a part of that conversation. And this is what he told the Japanese ambassador. There is in existence a stupendous force, as yet, happily, undiscovered by man. Let us supplicate God, the Beloved, that this force be not discovered by science until spiritual civilization shall dominate the human mind. In the hands of men of lower material nature, this power would be able to destroy the entire earth. This was in 1913. On March the 30th, he left Paris and traveled to Stuttgart. On April the 9th, to Budapest, from there to Vienna, and then back again to Stuttgart, April the 25th. He blessed a youth group at Esslingen and addressed an Esperantist meeting. In Wartenberg, the humble and devoted believers there erected a monument in his memory. I have a picture of the monument. Actually, I have several pictures I wanted to show during this, which were supposed to be shown from an opaque projector, which I understand you can put any kind of picture in it, and it will project it on a screen. Only it didn't arrive, and I don't know whether you can see anything from here or not. If you can't, it's not going to do much good. But this is the monument. This is in the Baha'i World, Volume 4. It's a very beautiful monument. It has this picture in the middle. Is it really too small to see? No. I'm sorry about the projector. This is in Stuttgart, where they erected it in his memory.
In Germany.
I'm sorry.
Is it still there?
Yes, so far as I know, it's still there. Yes. Thank you. In Vienna, he addressed the Theosophists. In Budapest, he granted an interview of the president of that university. He addressed the Theosophical Society, Theosophical societies are very big, I think, around the turn of the century and before World War I, as were the Esperantists. He met a deputation of the Young Turks, and met on a number of occasions the famous Orientalist Arminius Bamburé. Now, back to London for his second journey. He stayed for about a month, visiting Oxford, Bristol, and Edinburgh. It was when he consented to visit Bristol that he allowed himself the luxury and pleasure of visiting the friends in the countryside. Albeit it was winter time, this was in January of 1913. When he was in London, he breakfasted with the mayor. He met with members of the Muslim community and at their request visited their mosque and was invited to give an address there. The members of the Persian embassy entertained him, and the Maharaja of Jalawar gave an elaborate banquet and reception in his honor. He was always especially happy to welcome visitors from India. Professor Brown, you remember Professor Brown who saw at Baha'u'llah, visited him there in London from time to time and conversed with him in Persian. Mrs. Annie Besant, who was the leader of the Theosophical Society, met with him, and at her request, he spoke before the Theosophical Society there. He saw the Christian mystery play during Christmas week called Eager Heart, which caused him to weep. One afternoon, a Persian Baha'i from Ishkabab had just arrived in London and gave to Abu Baha a cotton handkerchief which contained a shriveled apple and a dry piece of black bread, which had been the gift of one of the working men, a Baha'i working man in Ishkabab, the only thing this man had. It was his gift to Abu Baha. When Abu Baha saw it, he opened it, partook of some of the food, and then leaving his own luncheon untouched, he passed it around to the rest of the Baha'i friends there so they could share this luncheon with him. Every morning, each morning when he got up, he would greet his host or hostess with the phrase, "Did you sleep well? Are you well? Are you happy?" He himself ate very little, but he liked always to serve fruits or sweets to the Baha'i friends and their guests. When he spoke before the Theosophical Society, he was asked about the Hague Peace Conference, which was in session at that time. And he said, now the following stories that you're going to hear are from a booklet which is now out of print called Abu Baha in London. And this is what he said about the Hague Peace Conference. "It resembles many drunkards gathered together to protest against the drinking of alcohol. They say to drink is terrible, and they straightaway go out from their home and drink again." I kind of like that. And another time, he spoke on gossip and unseemly talk about others. This is what he said. "Stories repeated about others are seldom good. A silent tongue is the safest. Even good may be harmful if spoken to the wrong person at the wrong time." At Bristol, in the countryside, it was observed, those who have been with Abu Baha notice how often, after speaking earnestly with people, he will suddenly turn and walk away to be alone. At such times, no one follows him, and all are struck by his free and wonderful walk, which has been described as that of a shepherd or of a king. And always everyone noticed his attitude with the children. He always seemed to have an arm around a child. And at Bristol, he dissertated on women. He said, this is a quotation again, "This is the age of woman. The woman is indeed of the greater importance to the race. She has the greater burden and the greater work. The woman has greater moral courage than the man. She also has special gifts which enable her to govern in moments of danger and crisis. If necessary, she can become a warrior. Taken in general, Women today have a stronger sense of religion than men. The woman's intuition is more correct. She is more receptive, and her intelligence is quicker. He didn't say deeper, he said quicker.
I think a man fainted back
there. The day is coming when woman will claim her superiority to man. But fortunately, we Baha'i women don't have to join any liberation groups. We already know. And another time, a Christian asked about wearing religious symbols. And Abdu'l Baha answered, "Baha'is often wear a stone with the greatest name engraved upon it. There is no magical influence in the stone. It is a reminder and a companion. If you are about to do some selfish or hasty action and your glance falls on the ring, you will remember and change your intention." And it was in the newspaper, The Christian Commonwealth, dated January 1st, 1913, that some of the best records of Abdu'l Baha's visit to London are printed. I happen to have an original on that. This is the original from Wednesday, January 1st, 1913, from an old Baha'i believer. But there's a beautiful portrait in here. The whole section was devoted, essentially, to Abdu'l Baha in England. And in this particular newspaper, it contains an account of his visit to the Salvation Army Center, where he attended a banquet served Christmas night with some 1,000 of London's poor who ate with him there. His address to Kingsway House, the account of his witnessing this Christian mystery play that I mentioned, Eager Heart, a long history and interview that was given to the newspaper by Abdu'l Baha, and then a short account of his arrival in Liverpool aboard the SS Celtic, and it describes one of the Persian entourage coming down the gangplank slowly, and he is carrying this miniature orange tree, and it was a gift from the Baha'is of California. It also contains his talk at Westminster Palace Hotel, and there's a translation in here of a tablet that he addressed to the Baha'is all over the world. And also in here is a reprint of his talk that he gave in San Francisco a couple of months back to the Jewish synagogue, the Temple Emmanuel. The entire address, it was so important they printed it in the London newspaper. During his second sojourn to England, Abdu'l Baha also visited Edinburgh in Scotland for 4 days. An account of his stay there is given in the little booklet called Abdu'l Baha in Edinburgh. I believe that's still in print. I'm not sure. This was compiled from newspaper articles in Edinburgh and diaries and notes that were taken at the time. Again, he addressed the Esperanto Society, the foreign students at the University of Edinburgh, the Theosophical Society, again, and his largest public meeting was at Rainy Hall. A newspaper criticized him and the Baha'i faith very, very harshly, but not too logically. And there is a reprint of that criticism in this booklet, Abdu'l Baha in Edinburgh, with the Baha'i reply. Now, when it comes to the United States, I had here a beautiful map, also in a Baha'i World number 6, that gives his travels throughout the United States, listing every state, which I wanted this to sort of keep up while I was getting this up. just for a second. But it starts and it gives the entire
trip by railroad all from coast to coast and Canada also. But if you're curious, and you can get hold of one of these books about his travels, this is
the only map that I know that contains his travels in the United States. But as Shoghi Effendi said, this was his culmination of his ministry, really, was the 8 months that he spent in the United States. He had come again from Ramla, Egypt, where he had passed the winter. And he arrived at New York Harbor April 11, 1912. During the time that he was in the United States, he visited 39 cities scattered from coast to coast, including this short visit to Montreal, Canada. And all in all, he gave a total of 141 talks during this time. Somebody, I guess, actually counted them up. 141. By this time, he would have been almost 69 years old and in very bad health. According to Howard Colby Ives in Portals to Freedom, he estimated that in New York City alone, he either gave talks or visited 53 different places. And this does not include his short, informal talks just to the Baha'i friends. These are public addresses. I'm going to give his itinerary in chronological order in case you're from one of these places and maybe you never knew that Abul Baha was in your hometown. This is listed in God Passes By. New York City, Washington, D.C., Chicago, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Montclair, Boston, Worcester, Brooklyn, Banwood, Milford, some of these I have never heard of, Philadelphia, West Englewood, Jersey City, Cambridge, Medford, Morristown, Dublin in New Hampshire, Greenacre in Maine, Montreal in Canada, Malden, Buffalo, Kenosha, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Omaha, Lincoln, Denver, Glenwood Springs in Colorado, Salt Lake City, San Francisco, Oakland, Palo Alto, Berkeley, Pasadena, Los Angeles, Sacramento, Cincinnati, and then Baltimore, where he disembarked then from New York to go home. He visited Montreal, Canada for a few days in September, right after he had visited Greenacre in Elliott, Maine, where he spent a very beautiful week. He liked it very much up there. There he found time to gaze at the thundering Niagara Falls. He granted newspaper interviews. He spoke at the Church of the Messiah. He spoke at the Unitarian Church, the St. James Church, Coronation Hall, and the socialist gathering, where he explained the difference between equality and solidarity. And many informal talks at the home of May Maxwell, little Mary Maxwell, who was then age 2, who was to be the future wife of our guardian. He would sit on his lap, and he'd stroke her curls, and he would say, "She is very precious. She is very precious." He cautioned her mother to restrain her spirit as little as possible, as he would teach her of the inner world. Newspaper accounts and interviews included the Gazette and the Montreal Daily Star. He was asked pointedly about the trouble in the Balkans and the risk of war. Most of the stories of Abul Baha in Canada come from a booklet called Abul Baha in Canada, which I believe is out of print. I'm not sure about that. I don't think it's in print. He warned Canada of the coming of World War I, and these quotations that I'm going to be giving are contained in the interviews that he granted to newspaper reporters and are printed in the Montreal Star. This is what he said on disarmament. And again, remember, this is 1913. All nations must disarm at the same time. In the absence of a universal agreement, armament must continue to be piled up against armament, and the nations cannot hope for release. All of Europe is an armed camp. These warlike preparations will necessarily culminate in a great war. There is nothing of the nature of prophecy about such a view. It is based upon reasoning solely. In another interview, he stated that the amount of money that it would take to support war in the future would make war economically unfeasible. When asked if a permanent peace could be established, he replied, "It will be established in this century. It will be universal in the 20th century. All nations will be forced into it. Disarmament is surely coming, but it must come, and it will come, by the universal consent of the civilized nations of the earth. By international agreement, they will lay down their arms, and the great era of peace will be ushered in. In this and no other way can peace be established upon the earth." Then there is this notation following it in this newspaper: "There is no other record of such specific statements having been made by Abdu'l-Bahá at any time on these questions of peace and disarmament than those which appear here reprinted from photostatic copies of accounts in the Montreal Star, Wednesday, September 11th. This was 1912, not 1913. And when it came time to depart, Abdu'l-Bahá told the Canadian believers, "The future of Canada is very great, and its historical events infinitely glorious." Upon his arrival in New York, this, and we're backtracking again, going back now to April 11, 1912, the reporters asked him what he thought of the Statue of Liberty as a symbol of freedom for America, and see what you think of his answer. He said, "There were three stages in man's development: freedom from nature, freedom from his fellow man, and finally, freedom from self." I like that. The Baha'i friends settled him in a very beautiful apartment, a suite actually, the most expensive suite in the Hotel Ansonia. But within just a few days, Abdu'l-Bahá moved out into smaller, less expensive apartments where he was much happier. He received much publicity in the newspapers and the magazines. He made this recording, the one that I mentioned earlier, the prayer that we read. And he called New York the City of the Covenant, because it was in New York that the very first reading of the covenant, the Tablet of the Branch, was read in English. It had just been translated. So New York has the honor of being the City of the Covenant. He spoke at the Church of the Ascension, the Church of the Divine Paternity, the Metropolitan Temple, the Mount Morris Baptist Church, the All Souls Unitarian Church, the Carnegie Lyceum, Columbia University, and the Bowery Mission. And it was at the Bowery Mission where some 500 men heard Abdu'l-Bahá speak that evening. And one of the things that he told them was, "His Holiness Jesus Christ said, 'Blessed are the poor.' He never said, 'Blessed are the rich.'" And at the end of his talk, he shook hands with each one of them and dropped a coin into the palm of each one of them and told them, "I consider you my relatives, my companions, and I am your comrade." And in New York, he met Alexander Graham Bell, the great poet Tagore, Andrew Carnegie, the Honorable Franklin McVeigh, Mr. Roosevelt, although it did not specify with any initials. I do not know which Mr. Roosevelt it was that he met. Does anybody know which Roosevelt? Was it Teddy Roosevelt? 1912, I guess so. He met Admiral Wainwright, Admiral Perry, and the British, Dutch, and Swiss ambassadors. He participated in the fourth annual conference of the NAACP. There are several stories that are told of his attitude and treatment of the Negro. There was an elegant luncheon that was being given in his honor, and a Negro man had evidently been invited, and he came about an hour early because he wanted to... No, he hadn't been invited to the luncheon, but he had been invited to talk with Abdu'l-Bahá. So Abdu'l-Bahá received him and noticed that no place had been set for him at the table. So he himself cleared out a place at the table. He called for forks and knives, set the place himself, and then the hostess did something she had never, never done before. The hostess served a colored man herself. And this was unheard of, evidently, in 1912. Howard Colby Ives, in Portals to Freedom, tells the story of the street gang of boys who were calling insults and names and throwing sticks and stones at Abdu'l-Bahá and the entourage that was passing through. And so they decided just to ask the boys to come up to Abdu'l-Bahá's apartments. So they came, and Abdu'l-Bahá, when they had walked in, noticed a vase of roses in his apartment. So he took one of the roses, you're familiar with this story, and he took it next to the cheek of the colored boy and said he was a black rose. And his friends evidently looked at him with utter amazement and eyes the way they had never seen their friend before. And he called out then for a big box of chocolate. And when this arrived, he took big handfuls, went around, gave all the little boys a big handful of chocolate. And again, when he came to the little Negro boy, he took the piece of chocolate and put it against his cheek, but he said nothing. And then he walked away. Everybody understood his point. And he also joined in marriage Louis Gregory, the first Negro Baha'i, and his bride, both of whom were of different nationalities and different races. And while he was in New York, he stayed for several days at the apartment of one of the early Baha'i teachers, Juliet Thompson, who was a very beautiful and talented young artist. And also staying there at these studio apartments was a then unknown poet from Lebanon named Khalil Gibran. The master consented to sit twice for a portrait so that both Miss Thompson and Khalil Gibran could paint his picture. Now, I don't know what happened to Juliet Thompson's portrait, but the one that Khalil Gibran painted is still being reproduced and it can still be purchased. He was then working on his book, The Prophet, at this time in New York. And Juliet Thompson records his remarks about Abdu'l-Bahá. "For the first time, I saw form noble enough to be the receptacle for the Holy Spirit. His meetings and conversations with Abdu'l-Bahá became the basis for much of his philosophy and poetry. The master attended several meetings of the peace conference being held at Lake Mohonk in New York. And someone asked him, they made a mistake again, they asked him what he thought of their chances for peace from this peace conference. And he replied by telling the Oriental story of Belling the cat." I never knew that was an Oriental story. But, you know, the little animals want to know when the big, fierce animal is coming by, so one of them is supposed to bell the cat so they will hear him coming. And he said that this peace conference was like that. He said, "Many, many words, but no deeds." And he said it would be the divine club who would break their power, meaning the aggressive nations. He was also asked to attend a meeting of the executive committee of the New York Spiritual Assembly. And after listening to their deliberations for about a half an hour, he calmly arose to leave. At the door, he paused a moment and surveyed the faces before him. And after a moment of silence, he said he had been told that this was a meeting of the executive committee. And the chairman said, "Yes, master." "Then why do you not execute?" And he turned around and left. It was in Washington, D.C., and he had a very unusual meeting with a Turkish ambassador. I'm not saying anything about that because bring home too many things. There had been the Turkish ambassador who had evidently met or knew of Baha'u'llah in the Holy Land and had scoffed at him. But when he met Abu Baha, he rose and with tears in his eyes, he gave this toast: "To the light of the age, who has come to spread his glory and perfection among us." An atheist who had been asked to describe Abu Baha said, "How would you feel the greatness of Niagara Falls?" Lee McClung, who was the treasurer of the United States, after meeting him, groped for his words. He said, "I felt as if I were in the presence of a great prophet, Isaiah, Elijah, no, that's not it, the presence of Christ, no, I felt as if I were in the presence of my divine father." Once, while being rushed from his third speaking engagement of the day to his fourth, he was heard to cry out, "Baha'u'llah, O Baha'u'llah, what hast thou done?" In contrast, when he addressed the Unitarian Fellowship in Boston, made up of the usual Unitarian intellectuals, he spoke to deaf ears. Several remarked, "A very interesting old man, but he has nothing new to tell us." And there is a similar circumstance, but in a different environment, which occurred in Dublin, New Hampshire, which is a summer resort for very wealthy intellectuals. One such person described Abu Baha in the only way she knew how. She said, "He is the most perfect gentleman I have ever met." A Baha'i hostess up there gave a very large informal dinner party for Abu Baha. And among her guests, she invited a famous scientist, two well-known artists, a noted physician, all in all about 20 guests, with generations of money and wealth and culture behind them. Some of them were very frankly agnostic. And the hostess was very worried and wondered how Abu Baha would handle them all. She wondered whether or not he would present perhaps a little fireside and give a history of the faith, or whether he would do what she wanted him to do, which was to give a talk on immortality during dinner. But Abu Baha, as the meal progressed, said hardly anything. And there was just a polite conversation of polite society. Finally, the hostess made an opening into more spiritual matters. Abu Baha responded by telling a funny story from the Orient, of which evidently he had a very great store. So several others told some jokes. And then Abu Baha told one anecdote after another, just laughing heartily after each one. Laughter was spiritual relaxation, he said. Then after everyone had gone, they'd all admitted that they'd had a very pleasant evening. And then he asked the hostess, had she been pleased with him? He spoke at a great many places in Chicago. One of them, the Jane Addams Hull House. He met Jane Addams there. She was quite impressed with him. One of the founders of the early liberation suffrage movement in Chicago. Hull House was a very famous place for liberated women suffrage. Yeah. Well, I think she was interested in all these movements too, though, wasn't she? I think she was pretty well known. And then it was on May the 1st, the thing that we really remember him for, on the shores of Lake Michigan, one of those typically windy days in Chicago, where he laid the cornerstone of the temple. He said that the temple already existed in the unseen world, and then he turned the first gate of earth, after which Baha'is of various nationalities took their turns also. I have a picture. Of Abu Baha on the Wilmette site after he had turned his first state of earth, dedicated the cornerstone. You can see that. He dedicated this stone on the behalf of everybody in the world. And he called this temple the Mother Temple. He also prophesied that when the temple was completed, there would be a great impetus in the spread of the faith. And true to his words, when the temple was completed in 1953, the faith was carried to 100 countries in 1 year. I also have a picture of Abu Baha in church somewhere. Is there a little slip of paper in that book that shows him in a church? You can. It's a very small paper. You probably couldn't see it anyway, but he's way in the back of the pulpit, this little figure, but very imposing. You can just barely see him. A very special occasion took place on June 29, 1912, at the home of Roy C. Wilhelm, in West Englewood, New Jersey. Abu Baha wished to leave behind him a gift to all the believers in the United States. It was his desire then to hold a special feast, a unity feast, which he himself, he said, wished to prepare. And so in this beautiful acreage at the Wilhelm Estate, in a tall pine tree grove, Abu Baha himself prepared a feast of delectable Persian food, which was shared then by all believers of every race and nationality and representatives of almost every religion who came there. And a great significance was placed upon this particular feast. It was a spiritual and a material feast, and it was designated the souvenir of Abu Baha. And he said, "For the sake of fellowship and unity, I desire this feast and spiritual gathering." A picture from that too. There again, there are about
100 or 200 people. I'm sure I can't help anybody, but this evening, after this talk, instead of having a closing prayer, we're going to have a different kind of a prayer. We're going to show an ancient film, a very rare and precious film, the only film ever taken of Abu Baha. There are not too many of these copies, I understand, that are still extant. And this film we're going to show tonight, right after the talk. So if you'll wait and not rush, it's only about a 15 or 20 minute film, and it takes place at the Unity Feast in West Englewood, New Jersey. Now, I used to know some of the names of some of the people who were present in this movie, and the only one I remember is a little girl in a white dress with long black curls, an absolutely beautiful little girl, and that's Marzia Gale. That's the only one that I remember. If there are any older Baha'is here who have seen this film and still remember some of the people, be sure to speak up. Is your mother, by any chance, in this film? But this will follow right afterwards without any ado. I think the movies will be over down there, and so they are certainly welcome to. They would enjoy it very much. Yes, as soon as they're finished, they're coming over with the projector.
Do we have a public announcement? They're coming with the projector.
A public announcement. Maybe Fred can do something about that.
I'll send somebody down to the cabin to make an announcement to the show
there. The will. The Wilhelm home was for some. The film will be shown in about 10 minutes, and you bear with me for just a about 10 more minutes, we'll have Admiral Hall through the United States. The Wilhelm Home was for some time used as the headquarters for our own National Spiritual Assembly. And Shoghi Effendi wrote that the pine grove and the grounds around it would be forever sacred, and that someday it would be the site for a beautiful structure which would stand as the only memorial of Abba Baha's visit to America. So every year since then, on the last Saturday of June, they hold a unity feast, which is a souvenir of Abba Baha. And they have the same commemoration, using the same words that Abba Baha spoke. And it was this film that was taken during this time that was taken by Mr. Wilhelm himself. He also spent, as I said, a week at Greenacre in Elliott, Maine. The story of that, if you remember, is Sarah Farmer was a very wealthy philanthropist, and she opened up her Greenacre school in 1894 to the study of all religions, and many famous people were drawn to this, many writers, poets, humanitarians of the day. But then she journeyed to the Holy Land and attained the presence of Abba Baha and became a Baha'i. So she donated her entire property after that to the Baha'i faith, where it became our very first summer school in the United States. On his way to California, he took the Union Pacific Railroad cross country. He stopped off at Lincoln, Nebraska to pay a call at the home of the Honorable William Jennings Bryan. It is recorded that Mr. Bryan, on a return trip many, many years before that from India, had stopped to call on Abdul Baha at Akka. He had even tried to see him a second time, but the Turkish regime there and the guards prevented him from doing so. So Abdul Baha was graciously returning the call. He was gone on a lecture tour at the time, so he met with Mrs. Bryan and her daughter and left a message. And in part, the message said, "I shall never forget our meeting in Akka, and ever pray that you may become assisted in the accomplishment of your service as to cause you to shine like a brilliant star. Your aims and intentions are honorable, and their full realization conducive to the public weal." When he finally arrived in San Francisco, he prophesied that the first flag of international peace would be raised in that state, which portended the coming of the United Nations in 1945, where they met to form the United Nations. He spent 3 weeks in October there and the surrounding communities of Oakland, Berkeley, and Palo Alto. And the most interesting ones are recorded in the San Francisco Bulletin and the Palo Alto Friday issue, November 1st, 1912. I also have a copy of that. This was put out as a commemorative issue in 1962, the 50 years of Abba Baha in the United States. There's a picture, and I went, oh, here it is, of David Starr Jordan and Abba Baha. He gave some interesting talks in San Francisco. I'm going to quote just a couple because they were so interesting. He spoke in the assembly hall at Stanford University before an audience of 1,800 people and 180 professors. And he talked about the folly of war. In part, he stated, "After all, a claim for territory is a claim for the dust, the love of the attachment to dust. Did you ever stop to think that when we live on this earth for a few days, and then we remain beneath it forever? So it is our graveyard eternally. Is it becoming to man to fight for his graveyard, which devours him, an eternal cemetery? For man to fight over his grave, to kill one another for his own grave, what ignorance." Then at his very famous address to the Jewish congregation at Temple Emmanuel, some 2,000 people were in the audience. He gave one of the best historical summaries and outlines of the Judaic-based religions that I think has ever been presented anywhere. If you can ever read it somewhere, do so. Part of the quotation and the thought that he left them with, I like very much. He said, "They, the Christians and the Muslims, admit that Moses was the interlocutor of God? Why do you not say that Christ was the Word of God? Why do you not say just a few words that will do away with all this contention? And there will be no hatred left, no fanaticism left, no warfare in the land of promise, no bloodshed whatever. Then there will be peace. Those are strong words to have used in 1912 to a Jewish audience. Further on in the same speech, explaining the symbolism of the prophecy of Isaiah and what would happen if nations and races and religions, which were typified by the lions and the wolves and the sheep, if they did not become unified, he remarked with a little bit of humor, "Otherwise you will never see the day when this prophecy will come to pass. For the wolf will never enjoy the companionship of the sheep, and the lion and the deer will never be seen together. Rather, the lion and the deer will see each other, but the deer will be inside the lion, and the sheep will ever be the prey of the wolf." And here's the story of the miner who had traveled on foot just so he could hear one of the talks of Abu Baha in San Francisco. He was uneducated, completely illiterate, and he sat in the audience and listened, and the interpreter would translate from Persian back to English. And he got very agitated. He said, "Why is that man interrupting all the time?" And then Abu Baha would say a few words, and then there would be another translation back into English. And he became more and more upset. He said, "He's doing it again. He is interrupting him." He said, "They should toss him out." Then finally the man next to him said, "He is translating from Persian into English." And the miner was astounded. He said, he's speaking in a foreign language. He said, "But anybody can understand what he is saying." And at the Unitarian Church, Abu Baha spoke on unity, since he told them that's what the word Unitarian meant. And he also gave a definition of the word angel. He said, "What is the meaning of the word angel? It means no other than a holy soul, a bright and radiant soul, a perfect soul, a divine soul, a soul which is the manifestation of love, a manifestation of reasonableness, a manifestation of knowledge, one who is not a captive to blind imitation." He spent 2 days, October 19th and October 20th, in Los Angeles. And we remember his visit here because of his pilgrimage to the grave of Thornton Chase. Shoji Effendi in God Passes By, and this is a quotation, says, "His special pilgrimage to the grave of Thornton Chase, the first American believer, and indeed the first to embrace the cause of Baha'u'llah in the Western world." And that is something I did not know, that Thornton Chase was the first Baha'i in the Western world, "where he stooped low and kissed the tombstone of his beloved disciple, an example that all who were there hastened to follow." I was going to read just a couple of sentences from the Tablets of the Divine Plan about what Abu Baha said about California. Do I have about an extra 2 minutes? Because I'm almost finished. And this has so much to do with pioneering in California, and I know most of you have read this. But I only marked a few sentences here because it was so applicable right now about what he says about not only the state of California, but the teachers and the believers in California. First, he likens it to Palestine. I know all of you have probably read this before, how California is so similar to Palestine in geography and in the types of fruit, things that it grows. It reminded Abu Baha very much of his own land. He said, "There are lofty mountains, deep canyons, great and majestic waterfalls, the giant trees, the soil is fertile and rich, and the state is similar to the Holy Land, and that region and that country like a delectable paradise. It is almost identical with Palestine, but because of the natural resemblances, heavenly resemblances must also be acquired. Now, California and the other Western states must earn an ideal similarity with the Holy Land." And here's what I underlined: "From that state and that region, the breath of the Holy Spirit be diffused to all parts of America and Europe. Particularly was I pleased with the meetings in San Francisco and Oakland and the gatherings in Los Angeles. Whenever their faces crossed my memory, immediately infinite happiness was realized. Then he says again, in that region, the field of service is vast. The minds are in the utmost degree of intelligence and progress. Sciences and arts are being promoted. The hearts are like unto mirrors, and they are in the utmost state of purity and translucency. And the friends of God are in perfect attraction. Therefore, it is hoped that meetings for teaching will be organized and instituted, and for the diffusion of the fragrances of God, wise teachers may be sent to the cities, even to the villages. He tells us then what we are to do now, I think. Then on this, he goes back to Cincinnati on his way back to the East Coast, and stopped off there because it was the hometown of President Taft, who was president at that time. And he said, I am most grateful to President Taft for giving his influence to the movement for international peace, and what he has done toward establishing peace treaties is good. But when we have the interparliamentary body composed of delegates from all the nations of the world devoted to maintaining universal peace and goodwill, then will we have the parliament of man of which the poets have dreamed. And his last public meeting was held at the Great Northern Hotel in New York on November the 29th, and it was referred to as the culmination of all his public addresses, for it was also a gathering of all the races. At this meeting, he did not mention anything whatever of the name of Baha'u'llah, the name Baha'i, or himself, but only the principles and teachings which had been his mission to promulgate to the Western world. On December the 5th, at New York Harbor, he embarked on the SS Celtic, which was sailing to Liverpool, England. And 100 of the friends had massed themselves into the largest steamship cabin, where the master spoke his final exhortation to the Baha'is of America. And these are a few of the last words that the Master left with us. Therefore, if anyone offends another, he offends God. The best way to thank God is to love one another. You have no excuse to bring before God if you fail to live according to his command. For you are informed of that which constitutes the good pleasure of God.